My name's Todd Rakes. I'm an alcoholic. My sobriety date is May 2nd of 1996. My home group is the Vero Beach Men's Group in Vero Beach, Florida. It's wonderful to be here. First off, I'd like to welcome the newcomers and those that picked up chips. If you're in your first 30, 60, or 90 days in Alcoholics Anonymous, I know it's very confusing. We're telling you to not drink, and then we're telling you you don't have the tools to not drink. So hang in there. It does get better. Otherwise, us that have been around for a little while would not be here. I'll clear up one more thing for you real quick before I get started. It's something that I've just recently learned from myself, and I had a lot of confusion when I was new about it. You'll hear a lot in Alcoholics Anonymous about insanity. Well, I'm going to share with you my definition of insanity tonight. You can take it for what it's worth, but if you're new here, this might be of importance to you. My definition of insanity is joining a 12-step program and not actually working the 12 steps. So if you're here in Alcoholics Anonymous, my suggestion to you, based on my own experience, is that you work these 12 steps. Because in over 15 years of being sober, I've never met an alcoholic who's worked the 12 steps in their entirety that will tell you that Alcoholics Anonymous is not the greatest single thing that's ever happened to them in their life, bar none. And that's true for me, too. When I had my spiritual awakening, it was something I cannot describe to you. I can only pray and hope if you're new in Alcoholics Anonymous, you get. With that being said, I am an alcoholic, and that means something happens to me when I take a drink of alcohol that doesn't happen to most people on this planet. And I didn't know that. The book calls it an allergy. I didn't know that. See, it seemed to me when I started drinking that everyone else got out of that bottle of alcohol what I did. You know, because everybody gets drunk. But what I didn't know is that the thing that happens to me, that allergy that the book describes, it goes down deep inside of me and it makes me feel better. And it doesn't happen that way for normal people. You know, if you talk to a normal drinker and they have six drinks or they get a buzz or they get a little drunk, they're drunk with problems. You know, I have six drinks or even four drinks or even three drinks and my whole world changes. Life is different when I drink alcohol than it is before. And I didn't know that everybody didn't get that reaction. And when I started drinking, I thought I drank like normal people. And I hung out, probably like most of you did, with people that like to drink like me, which is drink as much as you can, as fast as you can, until somebody stops you, you run out, or you pass out. And that's the way I like to drink. And so, you know, I hung around with these people, and I did not know that my reaction was different. But slowly, if you're an alcoholic of my type, you start to have problems. You can't go to the weekend without drinking. You can't go without drinking in the morning. You know, you can't show up without drinking. And that's what started to happen to me. And that's the second part of this first step. The second part of my powerlessness over alcohol is I start to become obsessed with alcohol. And my durations of being sober get shorter and shorter. And in those durations, I'm constantly thinking about drinking. And I became the man that you guys see so often that would stand outside of a liquor store waiting for it to open. I became the guy that would give up friendships and good things in his life to drink. Now, if you had stopped and asked me during that time if I was consciously giving it up for alcohol, I would not have been able to phrase it that way for you. But I can tell you this. Every time something got in the way of my drinking, I gave up whatever that was. And it didn't matter who or what that was. When I was in high school, I was blessed to be a pretty decent athlete. By my sophomore and junior years, I was having scholarship offers. By my senior year, no one wanted me to play for them. You know, I had to walk on to a college, and I had to beg the coach to take me. You know, and if you'd asked me or said to me alcohol was behind that, I'd have given you thousands of reasons that alcohol wasn't the problem. You know, I'd have talked to you about you or them or, you know, the bad breaks and misunderstandings in my life. But the truth was, every single time I took a drink of alcohol, everything became secondary in my life. And, you know, I became the kind of guy that would steal your wallet and help you look for it. You know, oh, man, that's terrible. I don't know what happened to your money. You know, I would find things before they were officially lost. You know, and you know, I would feel bad about those things. I got to tell you, you know, I was raised from good parents. My mother has never been drunk in her life. She just doesn't. She's never had two consecutive drinks in one night ever. They had bottles of liquor that were older than me when I was 13 and I started drinking and I relieved them of that problem very quickly. They still to this day, they, you know, my mom would say, big deal, you've been sober 15 years, you know. It's just she doesn't really get what I get out of alcohol. You know, to her, when she starts to feel alcohol, that's enough. She doesn't want that feeling anymore. And to me, that's getting started. And so, you know, I was raised with values and morals and good parents, and living like that was not the plan, you know, and I would feel bad about it, you know. I grew up in a small town, and you know, first night I drank, you know, I drank with older kids, and they got drunk, and they beat somebody up, and every Friday or Saturday night, somebody would get beat up, and you just hoped it wasn't your turn, and when it was your turn, you took it like a man, and the next weekend, it would be somebody else. And I grew up in that world, and I was okay there. You know, and if I got confused or didn't understand what was happening, I was fine with violence. I understood it. I would take physical pain over emotional pain any day. Physical pain heals. I understand it. You break your arm, you get a cast. You wait a certain number of days, the cast comes off, you're good to go. You know, if you hurt me emotionally, I did not have the tools to handle that. You know, rejection, not feeling comfortable, I did not know what to do with those feelings. And so I preferred the physical, and if I got confused, I would get violent. And when you're in high school, that doesn't mean a whole lot. You know, boys get in fights. People don't think, you know, that much of it. But as you grow older, that's not necessarily the way you want to behave. And society doesn't look on it the same. And you know, I've learned in Alcoholics Anonymous that I was just afraid. You know, and if you'd have told me that anger was fear when I got here, I probably would have thrown something at you. You know, because the last thing I wanted anybody to know is that I was afraid. But the truth was I was afraid. You know, and I don't know how I got that way, and I don't really care today. What I do know is that alcohol took that away from me. And when I took a drink of alcohol, that fear went away. When I took a drink of alcohol, if I was struggling to make a decision, I got clarity. And those things were, you know, important to me when I was 15, 16, 17 years old. You know, it gave me the courage to do what I needed to do. And you know, I did get into a college. I went to that college. And you know, I have a pattern, and maybe some of you can relate to this. My alcoholism works like this. If I get a job for the first month there, I'm the best employee they've ever had, bar none. Month two, they're not treating me right. They're not paying me enough. I could run the company far better than they could. I don't know what their problem is. And month three, I can't show up after lunch, you know, because I'm drinking at lunch and I just can't go back. And month four, I'm fired, you know, and I'm putting together the resume again and we're starting this all over again, you know. And that happened, that pattern happened, you know, my whole life. Every place I get, you know, I'm the best. My freshman year of college, I ran track, and in the history of the conference that I was running for, no one had ever, as a freshman, won the event that I was competing in. And so it became my mission, my goal, and I accomplished that. And it was the last time I quit drinking of my own will. And I quit drinking because I wanted to compete this goal. I put everything I had, my heart and soul, into this thing. And I did it. I was the first to ever do it. And standing on the podium, I'm getting my gold medal, and that wasn't it. And if you're an alcoholic of my type, you know what I mean when I say that wasn't it. You know, and the loneliest that I had felt in a long, long time was that night, because it did not do for me what I needed done. And the thing that did do for me what I needed done was alcohol. And so you better believe as soon as I got back to campus, I bought a bottle of Jack Daniels, and I finished that bottle off, and I felt a lot better. And you know, that was the last college sport I ever competed in. Because when it didn't fix me, it was no longer important. You know, and a couple months after that, I had been dating a girl, and we had broken up, and I had contacted her in a blackout or something, I'm not really sure. And her new boyfriend was not fond of that decision, and the school that I went to had a little mail room where you could go on campus and get your mail and stuff, and he decided to say something about that to me. And like I said, when I get scared or I get confused, I get violent. And I beat that man into the hospital, and a teacher happened to come, and the teacher tried to stop it, and I put my forearm in his throat, and I said, "You touch me again, I'll kill you." And you know, they frown on that at universities, and they decided they could go on without me. You know, and my dad had to come pick me up, my dad and mom have been wonderful people. They never turned their back on me, and I'm extremely grateful for that, but I really put them through a lot, you know, in my drinking. First time I was arrested, I was 13 years old. We were drinking, and you know, one of my buddies passed out, and we thought it would be funny, and we broke into a hair salon in town, and we shaved his head bald. And we decided to celebrate our you know, enormously bright idea. About 3 or 4 in the morning, a local bread company came in to start making their bread and saw all these, you know, teenage kids running around a hair salon and called the police. And that was the first of several trips my parents would make to police stations to pick up their son. You know, and I remember sitting in the police station waiting on my dad, and you know, I wasn't worried about being in trouble. I couldn't wait till Monday to tell the kids what had happened. I couldn't wait to see that guy have to face everybody Monday in school with a bald head, you know. And you know, I just didn't, my selfishness and self-centeredness, I didn't recognize the pain and the suffering that I was causing other people in my life. You know, and my dad had to make that drive one more time to the college and come pick up his son. And you know, when he did, it was silence for 2 of the 3-hour car ride. And you know, I didn't say anything. I didn't want to hear what he had to say. I can assure you of that. So I wasn't going to start the conversation. And when we got about an hour away from home, he said, "You know what? I don't care where you go or what you do, but you can't live with us." And that was not my plan either. And I had to get a job and do some things and work my way back into getting back into college. And the job I got a job working a sports maintenance crew at Virginia Tech, if any of you guys know where that is, in Blacksburg, Virginia. And that job consisted of taking care of the football fields, the baseball fields, the basketball coliseum, and stuff like that. And I loved it. It was the type of job that if you had a few beers at lunch, nobody cared. And it was the type of job that it was perfect for me. I would get off that job at 3 o'clock every day, sleep till 6:30 in the evening, go to the bars till the bars shut down, then go back, get a few hours of sleep, and get up and do it all over again. And that was great for an alcoholic like me. And I started having blackouts. I started having periods of time. And you know, the first blackouts you have, scary. You know, you wake up someplace, you don't know how you got there, what happened. But if you're an alcoholic like me, the second time gets a little easier. By the third or fourth time, it's just not a big deal anymore. You know, and I got to the place where I would wake up but not open my eyes yet. You know, and I would listen, and I would just sort of do a mental checklist. Do I recognize any of the sounds going on? Are all my body parts there? Am I wet? You know, I would unfortunately wet my pants on a fairly regular basis in blackouts and sometimes not. And you just do that mental checklist and you get up and you go about your day. And if you're someplace strange, you try and piece together how you got there. And you know, if you're not, you just go and make sure your car's there and you know, all that kind of stuff is happening. And you know, I'm 21 years old and that's the way I'm living. And I'm starting to have these blackouts and, you know, I'm waking up in cities that I didn't start drinking in. I woke up, I was living in Virginia. I woke up in Cincinnati, Ohio one morning. I have no idea why I went there now, then, or ever. Don't know anybody in Cincinnati. I have no idea. You know, I had gotten back into school and I would, you know, start drinking on a Monday night and miss Tuesday, Wednesday, and Thursday. You know, and not know what happened to him, and show up to my Friday class thinking it's Wednesday classes, you know, or go to my Friday classes and it's Thursday, you know, I was losing it. I became more and more antisocial. I found the morning drink fairly early on. I never had. I hear people say, you know, oh, I knew the morning drink was bad. I tell you, whatever conscious decisions I had about alcohol, they were never related to the word bad. You know, and I took the morning drink because it made me feel better in the morning. You know, and to me, why would some sucker sweat it out until 2 when they could start feeling better at 9? You know, and that's just the way, you know, that's the way my mind worked about around alcohol. And you know, by the time I was 21, 22 years old, I would get the shakes in the morning. Sometimes I'd throw up in the morning before I could keep stuff down. And I was, you know, getting so antisocial that now going to school required me to be fairly drunk, you know, and I have like any good alcoholic, I'm very delusional. I like that word. It described me magnificently when I was out there drinking because I truly did not believe that I was as sick as I was, you know, and this is how my delusion worked in college is I would go to class and I would have, you know, a plastic bottle and I would pour the Coke out and I would put the Jack Daniels in. And in my demented head, this makes sense to me. I would take the cap off, and in all these things, they have the little plastic piece. You've all seen that I have no idea what that purpose of that little plastic piece is. But I would poke holes in that with a knife, and I would buy fresh mint leaves at the supermarket, and I would put a mint leaf in the top of that and then shove the piece of plastic on it. And I would go to school, and I'd set my cap down, and I honestly believed you could smell the mint and not the Jack Daniels. And that's how delusional I was. And, you know, and I wondered why people didn't sit near me and stuff like that. But, you know, I wasn't showering much at that point, because I really had this fear of being too drunk to shower and falling in the shower. And since I lived alone, you know, no one finding me for days. So I just didn't shower much. And all of this time, you know, believe it or not, I'm somehow passing college classes. And I unbelievably, remarkably, get a degree from a university. And I make, you know, a lot of series of decisions in my life with alcohol at the foundation. And one of the decisions I made is that I was not ready to give up the college lifestyle yet, because if you work for a living, you can't get drunk at 9 a.m. And so I went to graduate school. Seemed like a good idea to me. And I went to graduate school at Marshall University in Huntington, West Virginia. And I'd never been there before I enrolled in school there. It was just the only school that accepted me. So it made it an easy decision. And I moved to Huntington. And like I told you, I'm a good alcoholic. I went and interviewed for a job and got a better job. I went and trying to get an assistantship, which most graduate students do. And I walked in, and my assistantship was supposed to be as a file clerk. And I walked out with the director of student services acclimating freshmen to college life. Don't ask me how I got that job. But my job was essentially that all the freshmen in the school would have to meet with me on occasion, and there were a couple other counselors like me, and we were supposed to help them transition from high school life to college life. Now, I carried a flask in my back pocket. I would steal from anybody, and I was never completely sober if I could help it. And I'm going to tell your kid how to adjust to college life. And to make it even better is, when I worked, I got a lunch break, and a lunch break for me consisted of walking across to this place called the Calamity Cafe, which is right off of campus, and drinking as many shots of Jack Daniels as I could fit in my system and still walk back to the second part of my workday. And I met with these freshmen faithfully. They showed up. We talked about something. And they went home. And I'm becoming more and more paranoid at this point. I'm starting to believe they are following me. So I'm driving my car miles out of my way because they are still back there, you know? So I eventually quit driving because it was too much pressure. And I had gotten an apartment that's walking distance to the liquor store and to a pizza shop. And so I felt like I was covered, you know? And the place where I would buy the liquor was a place called Big Bear, and it was a 24-hour grocery store. And I became the type of alcoholic that if I missed the cutoff to buy the alcohol, I would buy lemon extract, you know, from the grocery store. It has 40% alcohol, and if you put enough water in it, you can get it down. But I'm an alcoholic, so, you know, it'd be 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning, and I would be buying 6 bottles of lemon extract. And then, being a good alcoholic, trying to convince the person checking me out at 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning that I'm baking a cake. And when I had the money to go to the liquor store, I went first thing in the morning. And maybe you can relate to this. I got to this place in my life where I would walk into the liquor store, and you don't go straight for the bottle you want. And the bottle I want is the bottle I can afford. You know, if I've got the money, it's Jack Daniels. If I don't have the money, it scales down into whatever bottle I can afford. And I can assure you, I walk in there knowing exactly what I can afford and what I'm going to get. But I don't want you to know that. It's 9 in the morning. That's crazy. Who does that? Right? So you have to walk around the store and pick up a few things and look like you're browsing, you know, at 9 in the morning. And then I go up and I buy, and I tried to always buy half gallons because it was quicker that way and it made more sense to me. I would always say something to the cashier. Now, she saw me every morning, and there were like a couple of them, and they'd see me every morning shift they worked. And I would have a different lie every time. Oh, I'm glad you guys are open. I got to work late tonight, and I wouldn't make it back, you know. Or got relatives in town. And who needs to do that? I mean, clearly, you know, I'm there every morning. You know, who am I kidding? But I'm not delusional. I'm kidding myself. And, um, And I have a grand plan before I get sober, and most of you probably had a grand plan before you got sober, and I'll share mine with you. I had this grand plan. I started the process to start my own company, and this was my plan. I was going to start my own company, and I was going to go to the bank and get a loan for that company, and I was going to apply for a private liquor license, and I was going to take all the loan from the bank and buy all the liquor that loan would buy with my private liquor license, have it delivered directly to my house, to the apartment I was living on, so you don't have to go anywhere. And in my mind, I was estimating 100, 200 half gallons of Jack Daniels. That was the goal. And this was the plan. And then what I was going to do is I was going to declare bankruptcy shortly thereafter, drink all the evidence and tell you, what do you want from me? What do you want from me? You know, I got nothing. What do you want from me? That was my plan. And I really thought it was brilliant, but I couldn't get off my couch to start the paperwork for any of it. I just thought about it an awful lot. And my life got to the point where I was at that job one day, the electricity went out, and I was convinced they were all talking about me. So I just pulled out the flask and started drinking it and waiting for the electricity to come back on. And I reached the point where I realized that they were going to fire me, that they had turned the electricity off to force me out of my office. Oh, yes, this is how I think. So as soon as the electricity came back on, I got up from my office. I walked right past every single one of them. I didn't say a word, and I never went back. When I was a year and a half sober, I drove back to Huntington, West Virginia to make amends, and I went to see the guy that had hired me, the guy that was technically my boss that day. This is an indication of how my alcoholism works. He had no idea about any of it. They had could never figure out why I left that day. To them, they thought they had done something to hurt my feelings or something, because I just never went back. You know, and I had to sit across from them and explain to him what I had done, you know, while under his employment, and he was just shocked. I will say this for the amends process in Alcoholics Anonymous. When you have to look somebody in the eye and be accountable for your behavior, it changes you. Because the one thing I can assure you prior to coming to Alcoholics Anonymous is I was never accountable for my behavior. But to look at somebody in the eye and say, this is what I did, what can I do to correct that? Or what can I do to make that right? Changes you. And I can go anywhere on this planet and look anybody in the eye because I've made those amends. And the thing is, if I make a mistake today and I have to make another amends or I have to put another name on the eighth step, I know from my own experience that while it might not be the most pleasant thing in the world to clean that up later, if I clean that up later, I will be a free man. And I can go anywhere. I can go to Huntington, West Virginia. I can go to Blacksburg, Virginia. I can go anywhere that I want to go. And I'm not afraid of seeing him, her, it, whatever it is. You know, I'm a free man that way because of the amends process. And, after I left that job, my brilliant plan was to commit suicide because I could no longer, I couldn't take it. You know, I had gotten to the place where I couldn't drink enough. And there were, the consequences were so high enough, I couldn't see a friendly direction anymore in my life. You know, I was 22 years old, and I could no longer see a friendly direction. And I couldn't imagine. The worst fear for an alcoholic like me, I'll be honest with you, you know, people say if you go back out, you might die. That does not scare me. You know what scares me about going back out in Alcoholics Anonymous? Living. You know, and having to live the way I was living when I was 21 and 22 years old for another 40 or 50 years. I can't imagine a hell worse than that, and if there is one, I pray God I never go there. When I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, when somebody said to me, you know, you don't ever have to live that way anymore, that was probably the most powerful statement I had ever heard, because I didn't know that there was another way to live. You know, I didn't know that because I have that strange reaction to alcohol, that it had warped me, and it had put me in a place in my life where I could no longer manage it or function without this spiritual awakening that it talks about in the big book. I didn't know that had happened to me, and I truly believed my life was going to be this long, gray struggle until the mercy of death came to me. You know, and I thought I'd speed up the process, and I took 32 sleeping pills, and I sat there and waited to fall asleep and not wake up, and I had a bright idea, and I called an ex-girlfriend. Don't know who you'd call. But I called her to tell her I was committing suicide, you know. And, fortunately for me, she hung up the phone on me. But she made a second call, and she called the police, and they found me unresponsive, and I woke up in a hospital bed, and there were four people present: my mother, my father, my younger brother, and a strange man in the suit. And I intuitively knew that the strange man in a suit was going to be a problem. And, you know, and that guy said that, you know, I was a sick person and I needed help. And I couldn't deny that. I really couldn't deny that. And they recommended that I go into a detox rehab facility. And, you know, I didn't have any other plans, so why not, you know? And that was on May 1st of 1996, and I have not had a mood-altering substance or a drink of alcohol since that time. And this is why. When I got to Alcoholics Anonymous, I was completely and totally beaten by alcohol. I was out of plans. I was out of designs. You know, it didn't matter to me anymore. I could not see myself ever being anything. So it didn't matter that I had to come and sit with you. You know, and I didn't. Alcoholics Anonymous was not easy for me. My first year of sobriety was worse than my last year drinking. When I was a year sober, this is how I was living. I had a one-bedroom apartment with three pieces of furniture. I ran around the couch in that apartment for exercise because I was scared to go to the gym. I had a job in which I would go to that job and hide in the bathroom or the file cabinet for as many hours as humanly possible because I was petrified to talk to another human being. Then I would get dressed up, look a little nice, come to an Alcoholics Anonymous meeting, shake your hand and tell you that I was doing great, you know, and go home and do that all over again. I was scared of the pizza delivery guy, so I wouldn't open the door without the chain on it, slide the money through, have him put the pizza on the bottom of the ground, look through the peephole until he left, and then open the door and get my pizza, because you can't trust those guys. You know, and I'm going to AA meetings and telling you how great it is, you know, and at 11 months of sobriety, that was my life in Alcoholics Anonymous, and I became suicidal again. And an alcoholic of my type, before I commit suicide, I think of drinking. That just comes natural to me. I know it will help. And I started having those thoughts for drinking again. And I made probably an accidental, but the best thing I ever could have done, I actually shared that with somebody. You know, and the person I shared that with is my sponsor today, and he said something very simple to me, but at the time seemed very profound. And he said, you know, Alcoholics Anonymous works a lot better if you actually do Alcoholics Anonymous. Alcoholics Anonymous is not coming to meetings. Coming to meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous is a place we get together to experience the fellowship, and the big book says the fellowship replaces our drinking. But if you don't go beyond that, all you've done is replace your drinking with the fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous, and this is the problem. The fellowships of Alcoholics Anonymous will let you down from time to time because it's full of, guess what, alcoholics. And we don't treat people well, you know. Forming true partnerships with our fellows is not a strong suit. So, you know, if all you've got is the fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous, there's going to come a day where you're going to feel let down by that fellowship, and what do you have? And he said, what you need is the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous and a spiritual awakening. And I got started doing the steps with my sponsor at that time. And by 18 months of sobriety, I started sponsoring other men in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I have sponsored other men in Alcoholics Anonymous since that time. You know, and by 3 years of sobriety, I had made all my amends and I had completed the 12 steps in their entirety. And like I said, there is no part of me that believes I ever want to go back to my life before I did that. You know, but I know that I can, which is why I stay active in Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, there's a line in How It Works that was read, and it says, there is one who has all power. And it does not finish that with, that one is Todd. It says, that one is God. And guess what? If God has all the power, that leaves no power for me. Step one solved. There's no mystery here. It doesn't matter how long I stay sober. I will never have any power because all the power resides in God. So I continuously need you because I continuously need to plug into the power. And if I come here and I help you and you help me, then I am connected to that power. If I get too far away from you or too far away from the God of my understanding, I cut myself off from that power. And once I cut myself off to that power, things like taking a drink of alcohol make sense to me again. You know, because one way or the other, I am an alcoholic. I am going to die of alcoholism. I just can choose to spend my time with active alcoholics or sober ones. But a guy like me is going to be surrounded by alcoholics till the day he dies, because like find like, you know. And and I choose today to spend my life with sober alcoholics, you know. And my life is centered around Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, it is the center. It is the foundation. You know, I talk to my sponsor every other day at worst. I probably talk to him 5 to 6 days a week, you know, and that's because I need a sponsor in Alcoholics Anonymous more now than I did when I was brand new. And this is why, because now my life is full of other people and other things that I still don't know how to manage. I've never been this sober before. I can't tell you what it's going to be like tomorrow. So somebody still has to help me be this sober. And that person is my sponsor because he's more sober than I am. He's got more time in Alcoholics Anonymous and he's more active. So he knows what I'm going through today that I don't. You know, and I'm still on the spiritual path. I haven't reached any level of perfection, I can assure you. Ask my wife in the back and she'll confirm it. You know, I'm still a sick alcoholic. I need lots of help. And when I come to Alcoholics Anonymous, I get that help. And I mostly get that help by trying to give back to those from what I have discovered here. You know, and what I have discovered here is so important that when I meet a newcomer to Alcoholics Anonymous, I want more than anything for them to understand the magic in the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. I want them to know what it's like to not have that craving for alcohol. I want them to know what it's like to walk down the street and not worry about who you run into or what's going to happen to. And my sobriety hasn't been a bed of roses. I've lost jobs, houses, cars. This is my second marriage. You know, it hasn't been a bed of roses. I'm still an alcoholic, you know. I still make mistakes. But today I'm not afraid to look you in the eye and say I made that mistake and do what I have to do to correct it. You know, I believe a lot in 10, 11, and 12, and not as some kind of maintenance, because I know if I stop growing, I will not stay sober. But I believe that that is the power in Alcoholics Anonymous. It says something in the 11th step of our 12 and 12, which to this day I think is one of the most beautiful things and promises that come to me as an alcoholic. And it says in there, it says, when you combine inventory with prayer and meditation, you create an unshakable foundation for life. And I am a man that truly needs an unshakable foundation for life. And I find that in 10, 11, and 12. You know, I take my inventory on a daily basis. I don't always write it down. But I take it on a daily basis and I share that with my sponsor. You know, I am not afraid to look bad to my sponsor. He's heard my fourth and fifth step. He's heard my garbage for over 15 years. And he has not ever once told me not to call him back. So I'm pretty sure that whatever I do, God, my sponsor, and I are going to be able to handle, you know. And so, you know, I save myself the hassle, you know, and I tell on myself early, you know, because I know Alcoholics Anonymous is a solution-oriented program, and the solution is not ever going to come from me. You know, the solution is going to come from a God of my understanding through my sponsor and other members of Alcoholics Anonymous, generally in one of the 12 steps and how I practice them in my life. And in order for me to have that, I have to be connected to you guys. I have to make Alcoholics Anonymous the center. You know, and I have over 15 years of experience of knowing that if I keep Alcoholics Anonymous as the center of my life, every 6 months, and there's this guy, he's passed away now, but he was a big part of my early sobriety. His name's Frank, and he used to live in D.C. Some of the guys that have been up to the men's advance in D.C. may have met Frank over the years. But Frank used to say, every 6 months, your life gets tangibly and measurably better. You know, you just don't know what part of your life it's going to be. That's the great gift of Alcoholics Anonymous. You stick around here, and every 6 months, you get to watch some part of your life get better. And I can assure you that that's true for me. You know, I have areas in my life that have problems. But the truth is, none of those areas existed prior to Alcoholics Anonymous. And I'm grateful for the life I have today. Because it's far better than anything I'm capable of. And I know that because I know what I was capable of the day I walked into Alcoholics Anonymous. And I live so far beyond that, it's incredible. You know, people at work trust me. You know, I'm a teacher. People actually trust their children to me. You know, and my school trusts me. And I coach soccer, and the kids on the soccer team trust me. And my community trusts me. You know, the neighbors trust me, you know, and those things, that's not me. That's Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, I'm able to be a husband and a father today, not because I'm a good person, but because Alcoholics Anonymous has taught me a set of principles. When practice is a way of life, can enable the sufferer to become usefully and happily whole. That's what it says at the beginning of the 12 and 12. And I experienced that. And when I experience that, it gives me the opportunity to give back to others. And it says in our literature that the most important demonstration we can make is in our respective homes and business places. And that's where my inventory is taken on a daily basis, because I know from when I was in early sobriety that I can show up here, shake your hand, and tell you how wonderful I'm doing. But if you want to know how I'm doing, go ask my coworkers and my wife. You know, and if I'm practicing these principles as a way of a life, they will report good things to you. You know, and if I'm not, I hope they will tell me, you know, and I hope that I do something about it. But if you're new to Alcoholics Anonymous, you know, I hope that you stick around here. If you didn't relate to anything I say, that's okay. Keep coming back to this program, because if you're an alcoholic of my type, one day you will. And when you meet that person, or you hear that story, or you hear that thing, do what that person did, and I assure you, you will get what they get. And if they're a sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous, it'll be worth every inconvenience that comes along with it. Thank you for letting me be up here, and thanks for letting me share.
I was way back there. I'm sorry. I'm not sorry. Hi, my name's Jeremy. I'm an alcoholic. Dr. Bob's last message. I get a big thrill out of looking over a vast sea of faces like this with a feeling that possibly some small thing I did a number of years ago played an infinitely small part in making this meeting possible. I also get quite a thrill when I think that we all had the same problem. We all did the same things. We all get the same results in proportion to our zeal and enthusiasm and stick-to-itiveness. If you'll pardon the injection of a personal note at this time, let me say that I have been in bed 5 of the last 7 months, and my strength has not returned as I would like, so my remarks of necessity will be very brief. But there are 2 or 3 things that flashed into my mind on which it would be fitting to lay a little emphasis. One is the simplicity of our program. Let's not louse it all up with Freudian complexes and things that are interesting to the scientific mind, but have very little to do with our actual AA work. Our 12 steps, when simmered down to the last, resolve themselves into the words love and service. We understand what love is, and we understand what service is, so let's bear these 2 things in mind. Let us also remember to guard that erring member of the tongue. And if we must use it, let's use it with kindness and consideration and tolerance. And one more thing, none of us would be here today if somebody hadn't taken the time to explain things to us, to give us a little pat on the back, take us to a meeting or two, to have done numerous little kind and thoughtful acts on our behalf. So let us never get the degree of smug complacency so that we're not willing to extend or attempt to help that which has been so beneficial to us. To our less fortunate brothers, thank you very much.